I love the idea that you can't have people knowing what you're doing with the data and having a choice and then having performance as well. I love that idea that we have to invade people's privacy and have the surveillance economy in order to drive performance. That is insane to me.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Identity Architects, the InfoSum podcast that spotlights the leaders in the media industry shaping the future of data-driven advertising. I'm your host, Ben Cicchetti, and this week I had an incredibly important and impactful conversation with Andrew Spurrier-Dawes, Global Head of Client and Agency Enablement, Resolve at Choreograph. This is a critical conversation where we not only touch on Andrew's perspective on our industry landscape, but we delve into Andrew's passion for mental health awareness and mental well-being. This is an important conversation and one that we need to have more often in the media industry, but a quick trigger warning for those who may have struggled with their own mental health in the past, it may be a difficult episode at times. If you want to skip that part of the conversation, I suggest you leave us at the 31-minute mark and rejoin the conversation at 46 minutes. But without any further delay, here's my chat with Andrew. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by Andrew Spurrier-Dawes, Global Head of Agency and Client Enablement, Resolve at Choreograph. Andrew, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, and thank you very much for having me. It's a real honor. Thank you.
No, I'm super excited. For anyone who doesn't know you, can you give us a quick introduction to yourself and also to both Resolve and Choreograph?
Yeah, so Choreograph is WPP's data tech and analytics arm, which is great. Resolve is a relatively new company. As part of that, it's a cookieless. When I say cookieless, I don't mean that's. It's a semantic thing, right? Everyone's saying cookieless, and they're worried about this whole world where they can't see people, and we'll get into whether that's a good thing or not shortly, I'm sure. But it's a non-cookie reliant way of targeting people and way of finding people in a way that benefits publishers, advertisers, and the internet and people as a whole. I'm really excited to be here. I've been here for 6 months. Prior to that, I have been in the agency world 15 years, started off at Walker Media, legendary independent agency, and I'm super grateful for landing there. I was so lucky to get in there, and we can go into that. Brief stint at a publicist agency, and then went to Mediacom and Wavemaker. So I've been around for a while and seen a lot of change.
No, it sounds it. And nothing is probably more hot right now than the cookieless future. So we can definitely dig into that. But before we get into some of the more industry related topics, we're going to start the way we always do, which is with a series of quick fire questions to get to know you a little bit better. Starting with, what was your earliest memory of advertising?
Really difficult for a variety of reasons, but the one that I can remember looking out for, so when I was growing up, obviously there was no YouTube, there was no way of going to find an ad that you had seen previously. It was the Good versus Evil Nike advert, where people might remember, with Cantona kicking a ball through the devil, but it had Maldini and Figo and Kluivert, Thomas Brolin and Ronaldo in it. And that was during Euro 96, I think, based on my brief searching. So my earliest memory of advertising was remembering and waiting for the Good versus Evil Nike advert.
Nice, I love that. And so what, when you were growing up, what did you want to be? Was it a football player based on the memory of that?
I always tell people that, but I think that might be a lie. I really thought about it, and actually I think it was an architect, and I love the spaces where people, I'm not very good with people one-to-one. I don't know, might be a trauma thing, or might be just a self-preservation thing. I'm not very good with individuals one-to-one, but I love spaces where people are and they inhabit, and that's what really excites me. And so the idea of designing spaces for behaviors and for people is a really lovely thing. So I think it was an architect. I just love buildings.
I love that. But what was your first job in either advertising or marketing?
And my first job was McDonald's, but in advertising, it was going agency side at Walker Media, which again, super grateful for.
So what do you think it was that drew you into the advertising industry, and kind of what keeps you in it today?
It's an interesting question, right? Because I've worked with a lot of people who wanted to get into advertising and marketing and agencies, and they go and they study it. And I don't know, they have all these expectations of stuff that they've learned, and they're being taught by people who haven't been in the game for ages. And I mean, if I was teaching something about the industry that I learned 3 years ago, it'd be very different to now. Obviously, there's some the fundamental truths on marketing and branding and things like that, which you can learn. You don't need to go to uni to learn that stuff. So I applied for any job that I could in London. I'm a Cardiff boy. I needed to be away from home. I needed to go find my fame and fortune in London. So I applied for everything. I did an interview for Sky Sports News, where it would have been a bad job for me. It was, I don't know if you if you're in a pub and you see Sky Sports News on and you see the people talking and then the subtitles appear 30 seconds after, because at the time they had someone with a headphone on, a bit like I've got on now, listening in one ear to what was being said on the TV, speaking it and having the computer that was trained to your voice translate that into subtitles. And then so you were doing that and then at the same time monitoring what was coming out on the subtitles for spelling errors or misunderstanding by the computer so you could correct it in real time. So they gave me a 50-word spelling test with the awkward words like accommodation and things like that, which I failed horrendously, which not a problem. And I failed an interview for a market research company, which I'm very grateful that I failed it for. Really cool. I didn't know anything about London or Shoreditch. I'd been once in my memory. And so we went to a really cool agency and there was a car on a roof. It must be near Box Park or something. I thought, this is cool. And failed that. Then I got an interview to Walker, where there's a group of 15. It was a bit like The Apprentice. And it was a good format for me. I'm quite good at talking. Quite confident in what I was saying, and I nailed that, and that was great. And I'm in it because I'm not a big fan of adverts in my personal life. It's not something that I love. I think it's either because there's been bad experiences or I don't just like have it being interrupted so much. But what we are at the cusp of society. We pay for adverts, pay for media, they pay for content. That's really exciting. The people in it, you know, meeting you today is amazing. We got introduced by a brilliant person. There's some amazing people in the industry and it fits everything from right to left brain. I think that's a really wonderful thing. It's always changing. It's really stretching. It's really challenging to me on a personal basis in terms of my ego and how to deal with things. And it's given me, who's just, I'm just a normal person from Cardiff, a million opportunities, which I'm incredibly grateful for. So that's what keeps me in it. Plus, I'm not sure what else I can do.
I love that. I love that. And I love that lesson of, it's okay to fail. And in some ways, it's good to fail. Fail and fail, because eventually you'll land in the right place where you're meant to be. Kind of things will slot into place.
When do you learn from stuff going well? When stuff goes well, you go, cool. When you learn from failure, you go, okay, something needs to change. You can't really learn from within.
Yeah. I agree. I love that. So then what advice would you give to someone who might just be starting out in their career in either the media or the advertising industry?
So I'm very wary that I am a white, middle class, upwardly socially mobile, straight white man, and so giving advice is always something I'm very hesitant to do. And all I know is me. It's very difficult because all I know is the opportunities that I've been given and the choices that I've made. But the thing that's helped me the most in recent years is I feel like I've changed. I'm 37 now. I've changed recently for various reasons, which I'll go into later, is the realization that people are just trying to survive in the best way that they know how. And once you think about that in every situation, it totally shifts the game. Before, I'd be angry because I'd say people's behaviors are there to hurt me. The things that they do are choices because they're trying to undermine my goals. Actually, it's not. They're just trying to survive in the best way they know how. Maybe they've never been taught how to be a leader. Maybe they've never been told that behavior is unacceptable. Maybe they're just trying to survive because they've got something going at home, and so they're short temper. Maybe they've just had a kid and they're exhausted. Maybe there's a million things that aren't about me, And so my advice I would have given to myself is that the quicker you realize that people are just trying to survive in the best way they know how will help you in a million ways that you don't really realize.
Yeah, you just don't know what's going on behind the scenes, right? You don't know what other struggles people are facing. We all obviously have our own struggles, and you just don't know what struggles people are facing. And what their reaction to you, their treatment of you, is normally nothing to do with you and actually things that they're dealing with in their own personal life.
Nothing. It's that thing, isn't there, that we attribute someone's behaviors to or actions to a behavior in a way that they see the world. But when we make a mistake, it's just a one-off mistake. And so we implement their character and our actions, and flipping that, I think, is a really good thing. It's something I talk about with my team, is that there aren't bad things. There's something that happened, one. There's our interpretation of it, two. And then there's our reaction to it, three, which is the choice. But in two is you only know a tiny, tiny, tiny bit of the context. And so you get more context. You stop judging the thing that happened as good or bad. It's something that happened. You won't just try and understand as much about the content, and you choose your reaction to it, and suddenly you'll be far calmer, more harmonious in your own self. But it's hard, isn't it? Because we're all normal people.
Yeah, easier said than done. But I think it's great advice and great for people to keep in mind. So obviously we exist in a very complex industry, as I think we both know. So how would you describe what you do within the media and advertising industry to a 10-year-old?
Yeah, so agency side. I mean, having to explain to my parents what I did, it was I helped people decide where to put adverts. And now, being where I am, I help the people who decide where to put adverts to understand what their options are. And that's it. So for my kids, I've got 4 and 7-year-olds, it's I help. So some people are, so we'll walk past an out-of-home at a bus stop and we'll say, well, that advert might be, there's a McDonald's one by nursery, and say, well, this is on the way to nursery. So my job would have been to help them say why they should put it there and not round the corner, because there's a McDonald's on this road and not round the corner. So it's probably better to be here. So it's very simple what we do, but it's very complex to actually do it, I think.
Completely agree. What inspires you? You know, we talked about struggles. Everyone has struggles at different times in their lives. So it can be really difficult to stay inspired, to stay motivated. So what inspires you?
I mean, we could talk for hours on this, right? I think because there's the philosophical thing of, you know, people with limited options showing resilience and breakthrough. I think that's a really, that moves me. When people who don't have many opportunities, who don't have many choices, who aren't aware of their choices, showing strength and conviction to break through. But then also I hate the idea of motivation. I don't know, I haven't actually in my notes prepped for talking about some of the physical endurance events I've done. But when you push yourself, you can't rely on motivation, because motivation can go. And so discipline, I think, is a really interesting thing. Jocko Willink, the Navy SEAL who does leadership now, talks about discipline equals freedom. And I really like seeing discipline, having a focus and discipline. So that actually inspires me as well. So there's the big thing about people surviving ultimately, particularly people who haven't been given as many opportunities, which is a passion of mine. But then also people showing discipline and commitment, I think is really inspiring.
Yeah, I love that. Super important. So the last of our quickfire questions, and my personal favorite, because it always gives me a little bit of a unique insight into people. If there was a song that was a soundtrack to your life, what would it be?
This was the hardest of all the questions in all the categories.
It always is.
So we do Desert Island Discs in the team, and that gives me 8 chances. You know, Desert Island Discs, the radio show where it's brilliant. Yeah, so that's hard. One song is really difficult. So I've got 3, and I can break it down to 1 if you want, because there are rules to this. I appreciate that. So the Euro 96 album was my first CD. So again, back to Euro 96. It was my first CD, The Beautiful Game. Genuinely great. And it had Disco 2000 by Pulp. And that song has always meant a huge amount to me. I don't think there is a woman out there who I should have married. That's if my wife is listening. It's not that. But it's more just the needs, like the idea of the unlived life or things that didn't happen and regret. It's always something that's interesting to me. So there's that. The song I've listened to the most is Breathe by Prodigy. It's just on repeat all the time. I think I wasn't allowed to listen to it as a kid, the album and Fat the Land. And I love that album. And so there's a bit of rebellion in that for me. And it's also a great gym song. But the song that I listen to daily now is People's Faces by Kay Tempest, which moves me on a daily basis. If you haven't heard it, listen to the Glastonbury version, the live one. But the one from the album, A Book of Traps and Lessons, the whole album's unbelievably good. But that one, I mean, I get goosebumps thinking about it now.
That's brilliant. Well, we will add those to, we have a playlist on Spotify. We add everyone's Amazing. Choices to that. So we will add those fantastic choices. So we'll move on to some of the more, I guess, deeper questions is probably the right phrase to use. As we prepared for this podcast, and as I was doing a little bit of research, I was inspired by your advocacy for mental health awareness and championing the importance of mental well-being within organizations. And I think, fortunately, we are now seeing more and more people and organizations talk about mental health and why it's so important. But I'd love to dig into 2 areas. Firstly, why it's so important to you personally. And then secondly, what's the biggest challenges you think we still need to overcome for mental health awareness to grow and almost become just a standard support area within organizations?
Super interesting. I think it comes back to why is it important to me? So, I mean, I'm in a position of power as a just, you know, just through seniority, not because I'm anything special, but just through seniority, I'm visible. You know, I'm enabled to be on a podcast because of things that I've done. And so I have a responsibility for that power. You know, Spider-Man said that. And so what is my responsibility in that? Is it to take as much as I can, or is it to give as much as I can? I'm a firm believer that when people go through hard things, that there's two responses that they can go through, which are equally understandable. One is you can either make people feel the pain that you're feeling, or you can make sure people never feel the pain that you're feeling. And I've certainly on the side of trying to help people to at least understand any pain that they might be feeling, because I've been there. And I think helping people has always been just something what I've wanted to do. And again, it may be in a trauma response, in a self-preservation thing, where I just need, if people like me, then they're unlikely to hurt me. And so I've always, and if I give away a lot, maybe they won't ask more of me or try and take from me. So it's a control thing maybe. But if I go back, I think the thing about helping people, I remember when I was in college, so I was 16, 17, I was 17. You did that. You go and see a counsellor and they go, not counsellor, brain counsellor, but jobs, career counsellor. And yeah, does the questionnaire, puts it into a really old computer, like a BBC Micro, and it spits out what job you should do. And it told me that I should be a bin man, bin man. For me, it was a bin man, which nothing wrong with that at all. I quite like the idea. I've always wanted to be a street sweeper, you know, going back to the architect question, because you can just be there. You're in the moment, you're in the zone, you do a job, you create something. But imagine what would have happened if they told me I could have been anything, or I could have been a CEO of a bank, or I could have been a therapist, or I could, you know, imagine that if they'd given me my options, if they, that person in power had been in a place, it told me what was available. And also, I am 100% sure they're not telling kids in Eton or Winchester that they're going to be bin people either. And so I have to stop that happening for other people. I have to enable people. And mental health is something that I've been through. It's interesting, right? Mental health is something that everybody's got. It's exactly the same as physical health. You can go to the doctor when you feel at the peak, and you can always be better, or you can always understand more about yourself. I've been lucky in the sense I've been through a couple of really dark things, which I'm very happy to talk about if that's of interest to you and the audience. And so I've had to learn a lot about myself, and it's helped me understand myself in relation to work. And so that's why I'm such an advocate, because I've got to use my position to help. I have to, and I have to share what I've understood, maybe to help me, but also to enable myself to help people. And also, it's part of the, I think it's just, there's something deep in me. One of the bits of feedback I got at MediaCon was that my favorite bit of feedback was that I have intimidating fearlessness, where I'm just not worried about things that can happen, probably because I've been through things that have hurt me way more than anything that can happen in work. And so I have to be using that fearlessness to help other people. And I think it does. And so that's it. So that's why it's important to me. The biggest challenge we have overcoming mental health awareness to grow and become a default factor in organizations, I think, is a really difficult one, because it makes me think about what responsibility an employer has towards the mental health of its employees. Do I want my employer being my therapist, being my nanny? I'm not sure, but I think what it comes back to is what the cost of work is and what the responsibility of work is. Our jobs are a mix of art and science. There's magic, there's data, there's creativity. It's a wonderful thing, but creativity takes time. Time is such a valuable resource, but I think we're seeing a lot of efficiencies come in from procurement departments who are trying to reduce out all of our outputs of very binary data. You know, it's on or it's off. This is the product, this is how much it costs. And then that leads to ways to make that product more efficient, to cut corners and get more for less. And what the cost of that is always people and time, always. And so with the cost being people and time, there's a cost in the quality of the product and ultimately the health of the people that work. And so there's, you know, the people I love. So there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of the chats about AI and efficiencies there, and there's a lot of restructuring happening in a lot of different agencies and a lot of different groups. And so that's being resolved now. I'm not pointing fingers at anyone or anyone in particular, because it's just part of business as well. I look at one of my heroes is Giles Edwards, who runs the GASP agency. They charge by the product. So it's not the outcome, it's not time spent, but by the work. And I think that's an incredibly brave and powerful thing to do. And it's also a signaling of the quality of work, because they have to deliver. So they're going, cool, we'll deliver. We will deliver great work, but what you get from us is great work at the right time. And so I'm really proud to know Giles. Giles is a hero of mine anyway, I love the man, but I'm really interested in how Garth do that.
It's super interesting. And, you know, one of the things you said that really resonated is, you know, there is still such a stigma around mental health, because I do think there's this concern is how much do you want to share with your employer, right? Because there is still that fear that you could be held in a more negative light. You could be seen as quote unquote being weak and not able to handle the pressure that's being put on you. So it's how do you balance how much you share? And I think as leaders, obviously we have the opportunity to be more open because we're potentially in a more secure position as leaders, and therefore we can set the example for others. But it's still an intimidating thing, right? To be open, to be an open book. How have you found that? Clearly you are such an open book about this. How have you found that?
Yeah, I mean, my default is open. And I, like I said earlier, I think that might be a self-preservation thing, because maybe there's some areas which you'll never get to. Maybe that's the vulnerability that I need. It's almost by being vulnerable enough that I don't have to be vulnerable or appear invulnerable. So I think there's areas that I need to examine. But I also think you share a little bit, and it's almost like a muscle. You get used to sharing a bit, and the scary thing, it's like I was talking to my daughter about Jurassic Park, about films that I'm really excited to show her, but maybe she isn't quite ready for because they're scary. Like Jurassic Park, and we were talking about, she was like, well, what's scary about dinosaurs? And her thing is, she's similar to my wife, is highly sensitive. It's really wonderful because it's something I've struggled with. And so she sees and understands things and emotions and people way better than I do, and she's 7. And so the things that frighten her in films are things that could be. And so it's not seeing the dinosaur that will scare her. It's not seeing it, like Jaws, you know, is not seeing it. And I think that's what we're scared of, is what could happen. You know, I've known a great many troubles and only experienced a few. It's that sort of thing, is what do we think people's reaction will be to, I'm depressed, or I've had episodes, or I need a break. I can't just be running 100 miles an hour, or whatever it is. And we need to realise that, one, people don't care about us as much as we think they do. And two, actually, there's power and strength in that. Is, you know, it's like we've all did those meetings where you start off a meeting by saying, ask any question, any stupid question, because if you're thinking about it, someone else will be as well. And that's where the power in sharing comes from, is about legitimizing and giving a language to what other people are sharing that they may not yet understand, or they may not feel that they're able to share yet. And I think that's the power of it in terms of why I'm able to share.
Yeah. I think it's amazing, right? That, you know, as leaders, we can take on that responsibility and we can take on that visibility, is almost the word I use. So obviously, you know, myself as an LGBTQ plus leader, I like to be a visible LGBTQ plus leader, because I'm aware that, to your point a little bit earlier on, I have a certain amount of privilege as a white cis man that other members of the LGBTQ plus community just don't have. So therefore, if I can use my visibility to enable others to do the same, then I take that as a responsibility. But it also gives me a sense of purpose, and it, you know, I get a warm feeling when I'm able to do that, and when I'm able to see other people around me who benefit from that. So that kind of level of responsibility, I think, is really important.
Yeah, 1,000,000%. And there's so much to unpack there, but yeah, responsibility and the ability to share. And I'm a big friend or ally, the LGBTQI+. Because what I find is a lot of the people that I've spoken to and the members have been through a process of self-realization and self-actualization. They've been through a lot in terms of that. And so there's a lot to share and a lot to understand. And so representation of that is really important. So one of my close friends, Chris Poweros, again, a hero of mine, like when I grew up, I wanted to be like Chris. She set up the first official football supporters club for LGBTQ people, the Proud Lily Whites. I've been podcasting for a long time, so we were the first people to give them space to talk. And so we had a LGBTQ special on the show, and she's now a regular host. She's a very close friend of mine, and we talk about this a lot. And I think it's a superpower in many ways, and so that it's important to be an ally there as well. But yeah, I totally hear what you're saying.
So if we bring things back to the media industry a little bit as well, you know, I believe that the media industry has an incredible power to influence public perception on multiple critical topics that we've kind of already covered. So in your opinion, what role can the media industry play in raising awareness around mental health and removing some of those stigmas that we've already touched on? I think about this in particular around men and mental health, when we remind ourselves that suicide is still the biggest killer of men under 45?
Really complex question. Really, really complex question, because it talks about what the role of advertising the media industry in society and what responsibility we have and what behaviours we encourage. Men, there's a lot to unpack there. I think there's a huge amount to unpack there. I'm really interested in the idea of third spaces at the moment. So third space, you know, the idea that your first space is your home, your second space is your work, and then the third spaces is a space outside of those where you can hang out. And we're seeing a dramatic loss in them in society. You know, it would be where can you go now that to hang out that's cheap? You know, bars aren't cheap anymore, swim pools aren't cheap anymore, there's no youth clubs anymore. It's a problem, because what we're seeing then is the loss of community, and that's a challenge. And so what do our advertising dollars pay for? I think so I started mentoring a youth in Stevenage, a guy called Jamie. He's a really lovely man. We started off wanting to talk about his anxiety and confidence, which we talked about, and we've gone through and we've nailed that, frankly. And now he's asked me, how do I talk to girls? And firstly, I was a bit, you know, I'm the worst person in the world to talk about. I've got no idea. Because, you know, I mean, my way of talking to girls back in the day was if they wanted to play dead on, I guess. I really don't know. But actually, it spoke to a fundamental truth of where do you go to speak to girls? Because he was in school. Then he's 19, turning 20 this month. He's been told, like, go into the world until you die and try and be a productive member of society. And where do you meet people now? He's in Stevenage. Stevenage is just roundabouts and concrete. Like, where do you go? Mm. And he's got a real change. He's just got no spaces to hang out. So community, I think, is really important. So what community are we encouraging? And what is that connection? Where's the connection coming from? I think the internet is responsible for that. And so what world are we encouraging in our investment in the internet? The internet, you know, back in the day was great because you'd go train spotters rather than having to hang out on platforms. Now could hang out on message boards. That was great. But now the internet is encouraging all sorts of behaviours about trying to make your life seem like highlights and trying to make yourself seem perfect. And there's no humanity on the internet. And I think that's a real challenge. People are really missing that connection there. So I think we have to set examples within the industry. So it's really hard for me to say people should advertise like this, because when we start seeing purpose-based advertising, I think people are now wise to it and quite cynical of it, because, you know, that phrase is it's not purpose until it costs you money. Patagonia are obviously great at it because they'll do things for the cause. But people now are seeing through a lot of the purpose-based advertising, where if it's right, it's right. But if it's purely there for you to use it as a campaign topic, then that's wrong. If it's there for profiteering, then that's poor. So I think actually we need to look internally as much as being careful about the purpose. And I think there's a massive space for leadership training. And there's a huge difference between management and leadership. Huge difference. One, and we promote people often because they're great at their job, right? You say you're good at putting a plan together, you're good at optimizing SEO, whatever it is. Suddenly you're in charge of one or two people and you've got a completely different job. And suddenly you're in charge of the future and the standards that are set and the culture for this young person. And why do people leave jobs? Why do people stay jobs? It's because of people. It's not about money. People said, Joe Strummer said, without people, you're nothing. And so we have to think about the humanity and the connection that that we're building in the industry. And it has to start with leadership training, I think. And so that will be better for mental health in the long term, I think, because it will, rather than trying to stop symptoms, it starts to understand the humanity and it will bring compassion and empathy in a profit positive, in a growth positive way, but also in a growth positive way for people as well. When it comes to things about what we need to do now about things, you know, suicide being the biggest killer of men under 45. I'm not medically trained, so I can't give recommendation on that, but we need to be aware of pressures people are under. And I think leadership will help that. I think understanding people will do far greater benefit than most other things that we hear talked about in the industry.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think, you know, it's such an interesting concept what you talked about there about kind of third spaces and how we keep those kind of safe. I think my concern when I look at like my nephews and nieces who are all teenagers now, my concern is that kind of third space becomes social media, which, you know, obviously social media has a lot of positives and I can see those positives, but also, you know, no one can deny the incredible impact that social media has had on people's mental health, to your point where you are dialing everything down to a story or to a highlight, or, you know, everything is a filtered view of your lifestyle. So it's how do we keep those safe spaces and those third spaces positive and kind of reinforcing, rather than creating more and more complex issues for people. I think it's really important.
Where's the humanity? Where's the comparison set coming from? Is it from an algorithm defined group of highlights of people you'll never know, who aren't from where you are, who are trying to sell an image and trying to sell something? Or are they from your community where they're not filtered? It's people going through struggle. It's people who will be able to help you when you're locked out of your house. Is it people who care about you, where you've got a joint ambition to make where you live and everything you are brilliant, and who share a connected set of ideals? That's the maybe the shift in ideals is from being community based to being online based has been quite a damaging thing, I think.
Yeah, I agree. This is a reminder that we're about to delve into some of Andrew's personal experiences. This is an important conversation, but a trigger warning that it might be difficult for some people who have struggled with their mental health in the past or at present. If you want to skip this part of the conversation, please jump to the 46-minute mark. But for now, back to my chat with Andrew. So we put this question down, but I actually think it's a really tough question because I'm not sure how I would answer it if someone asked me this. So I'm super curious to get your perspective. What advice would you give to someone who right now is struggling with their mental health in a corporate environment?
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about my story because it's been hard. But I don't want to use it to shoehorn my, you know, to make people think, you know, feel sorry for me. My, I don't know what to speak. So I've always struggled with depression and, but I've never been anxious at all. You know, that intimidating fearlessness. I've never had a problem talking to people, talking to senior people in meetings. It's never been something that's worried me. And then I've told this story before, but I got a job in China as head of digital strategy for MediaCom in China. Dream job, like literally dream job. Go out there, go somewhere completely different, go on an adventure. They're amazing clients, like genuinely amazing clients, brilliant people, going and completely different internet to what we know. So even though I learn unique things over there, the power of the understanding will massively apply to wherever I go in the world. And imagine I can come back and say I've done digital strategy in China, globally, UK, superpower. So we went out to China. So we had a 2-year-old. The first one was really hard to conceive. The second one wasn't coming either. And I went out to China. The house was empty. My house was empty. We had a contract to rent it out. My wife wasn't coming with me on that trip. I was going out to meet the team, meet the clients, set everything up, go look at apartments, finalize apartments. But my wife was actually really weird. So I said, "Can you just take a pregnancy test?" And then as I landed in China, she said, "You know, I'm pregnant." And so I hate lying. Like, I'll never lie to you. But I had to be in there for a week saying, you know, I couldn't be there for a week and say, I'm not even going to stay here. So I might as well not do the work. So I had to do the work, but then also knowing that we probably weren't going to move. Not because there's anything wrong with China. It'd probably be better to have a baby in China, but we needed our network here. We needed to be around grandparents and things. Got home a few weeks later, mum phoned me up and said, "I've dinged. I'm in hospital because I've dinged the car. I can't use the right-hand side of my body." And we went, "Oh, okay." And then so that was a Friday. On the Sunday, it was like, "I've got cancer. I've got a tumor on the brain." And then a week later, it was, "I've got stage 3, level 4, level 4, stage 3. I can never get it right. But the worst type of cancer in 12 places in my body, in 12 locations." It was more a case of where wasn't it? And she had a scan of a brain, and it looked like a constellation, like a galaxy of stars, like the opening. It was awful. And her death date was the same day as my wife's birthday, which was the same day as my baby's birthday as well. So November 23rd, 2019 was planning to be a fairly horrific day. So I couldn't go to China, didn't have a job. I had a job, so I had to, I had employment, but I didn't have a role because I was moving to China. So they had to re-find me a new role. So on that client, mum was dying. Emma, wonderful wife, pregnant, which is hard. I got a 2-year-old. This was difficult, right? Yeah. Then you fast forward. So I was struggling with my role within that. Well, what do I do? My dad's disabled. It's a brief interlude. He had an accident when I was 13, so he had a heart attack and fell face forward in the when he was holding a cup of tea and cracked his head on the oven. So and he's got brain damage. So from the age of 13, he's got brain damage. So I've got no memory of life before 13 because, I mean, openly he was. He had violent mood swings, violent mood changes, and he had all sorts of things going on in his life as he was emasculated by it. He couldn't work anymore and he was struggling with that. But that really impacted me then in my formative years. So, but he's disabled now, trying to look after mum and trying to survive. Emma's trying to not think about her birthday and the death day and the birthday. I'm a passenger trying to look after this too, Rob. Mum is dying and she's looking bad because of all the stuff that's happening to her. And fast forward to November 23rd, Emma's birthday happens, and thank God mum didn't die and the baby wasn't born. But then November 26th, we go and basically say goodbye to mum. Say, you can go, like, don't hang on for us, which is quite a hard conversation to have. Came back 8 o'clock, Emma starts having the baby. We're trying to have it at home just because you need a relaxing atmosphere, and the hospital isn't particularly relaxing, but it doesn't work. So at 2 o'clock in the morning, they blue light us to Lister Hospital. Wonderful, wonderful hospital, wonderful people. Baby comes out at 6, so which is horrific. I birth is always horrible for me because I've always had fear of my wife dying. And so it's a horrible thing to go through. But then I'd say to the nurse at 6 o'clock, I just, for the love of God, please let me take this baby home to meet my mum before she goes. I just want them to breathe the same air, have a photo, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And then they're like, cool, as long as your wife can do these bodily functions, then so we know that she's okay. 2 o'clock. So that's the 6 o'clock. She has some toast and baby's fine. It's a massive, hairy baby, but it's great. The girl, we phone mum. We say it's Ellen, which means, as a Welshman, I needed some Welsh in there. So it means light. We needed something positive. And then at 2 o'clock, my brother calls and says, she's gone. Like, and so I have to go to the nurses and be like, I'm not in a rush. Don't worry about it anymore. And so that was tough, man. And I did not know how to deal with that pressure. Because who does, right? Who has a book to say all of the things? Your dad's suffering, your mum's gone. Really, you lost her before, but now it's confirmed. You've got a new baby, all of this stuff. And I had to get help. I was depressed and I was struggling with frustration and anger, which I've always struggled with. And I went through therapy. So that was November 2019. So then obviously lockdown happened. So we were locked in the house with all of that emotion. Couldn't hug dad, who was going through it, who's living by himself, but in the house that had mum's clothes in, had all the decorations. So pretty rough. So went through therapy. It was helpful to be able to give language and left and right brackets to what I was feeling. And as in, this, it defined it. And so I was able to understand and I was allowed to feel those things, which is a really important thing, but it wasn't good. So then I stopped that. I went through my allocated hours. I had an extra 10 to 30 hours there. And then I changed jobs to Wavemaker, which is great. Suddenly everything fell apart. I got diagnosed with severe depression, PTSD, anxiety, OCD, and psychosis, because I was actually hearing voices, and it was just an insane time. My OCD comes out as, and I've had this ever since dad's accident, it's not switching lights or cleaning my hands or whatever. It comes out as I've just this constant train of dark thoughts in my head. It's a bit like A Beautiful Mind, you know, when at the end when he has to ask a young woman, is this person really here? It's just, I've learned, it's just commentary in my head now. And then psychosis, hearing voices. And I've learned how to deal with it. And not deal with it, I've learned to understand it. I'm not fixed. So I've had 40 more hours since then as well. So I've had 70 hours in the last couple of years. That's me. And all the time I've been working. And so I would say I would have been struggling with my mental health. There's been times where I've wanted to cry, hide in the toilets. And so the thing I realize is people will give you space if they know. If they don't know, how can they help you? So the people at Mediacon and Wavemaker were unbelievable in saying, you do what you need. I've never seen anything greater in the compassion than I saw from the people there, from the team on Mars, and then the team at Wavemaker. Clients were great as well. Just, what do you need? we know you're still doing the job, that's cool, but you don't have to nail everything. Like, let's share the load. So there were wonderful people who helped me there. But what I learned, you said right at the beginning of what advice would you give to someone struggling with their mental health in a corporate environment, is you need to sort you. And there's quite a hard line, but like, you're responsible. You have to do it. You have to do it. You have to not dwell on it. You have to understand that the business's first priority is the business's shareholders and growth. And that's not a problem, but there's lots of ways to get help from within that. There's lots of support systems. So if you can get it on insurance, therapy is brilliant. Businesses provide that. If not, speak to your GP. If not, speak to me. My personal email address is asdaws@gmail.com. Speak to me. I'm here. But I think you need to take responsibility about recognizing that you are feeling these things. Recognize that you need to understand what the source of these things are. You need to discover you. And that our world isn't built to heal people. I've just finished a book called The Myth of Normal, which is Trauma, Illness and Healing in a Toxic Culture by Gabor Mate. Recommended to me by my therapist, but it's amazing. And in that he says, the meaning of the word trauma in its Greek origin is wound. Whether we realize it or not, it is our woundedness or how we cope with that that dictates much of our behavior, our shapes, our social habits, and informs our ways of thinking about the world. And so a lot of the struggling with the mental health in the corporate environment has roots in our behaviors and our interpretation of things. So you have to understand the origin of the wound that's causing that. And wound doesn't have to be, you know, a huge stab in the side. It can be lots of little behaviors that you've been socialized into. The book goes on to say, research has shown beyond any doubt that early experiences mold behaviors, emotional patterns, beliefs, learning styles, relationship dynamics, and ability to handle stress and regulate ourselves. It's really important just to understand ourselves. Let's work out what you need to learn about yourself. Do you need resilience? Sometimes it's like, you need to put your big boy pants on. This is work. This is what being an adult is. But do you need to speak to someone? What questions are you asking yourself? What are you answering those questions with? We've talked about the three elements of stimulus, about there's the thing that happens, which isn't good or bad. There's your interpretation, which, as we've heard, it's all about your socialization, your choices, your influences, and the context. And then there's your reaction to it. And then, at the very, very baseline, I've got body dysmorphia as well. I've got a real problem with thinking I'm overweight and fat. And so I'm constantly yo-yoing. But one of the things with fitness and health is we all know what the answer is. It's not difficult. You need sleep, you need water, you need exercise. And it's the same with mental health. You need sleep, you need water, you need exercise, you need connection, you need to speak to people, you need community. And I think you need to make something with your hands. I think making something, having control and having some element of mastery is a real good way of gaining that control that you're missing as well. Sorry, that was a very long answer, because it's a difficult question, but also I don't think it is, in terms of there's a responsibility of self to get understanding and to get help. And it goes on from there.
I mean, you know, thank you so much for sharing all of that. I can't understate how important it is that I think people hear these stories and hear kind of how other people have struggled, you know, had significant struggles, but are now in a more positive place, right? And the fact that probably people may have looked at you during that period of time and thought everything was fine because you were, you know, you were still firing on all cylinders, doing all the work you needed to do, hitting all the results you needed to hit, but they would have had no idea what was kind of going on under the surface, kind of the iceberg thing, right? You know, on top it looks fantastic, and it looks like nothing is struggling, but underneath there's all this weight that people are carrying with them. So I just think being able to share that and hearing that, obviously it's I'm so sorry obviously that you went through that, but to hear how you've managed to tackle it and to hear how you've managed to put so much of that into perspective and to kind of, as you say, come out the other side is kind of almost feels like the wrong phrase, but to be in a more positive place today.
Yeah, I think being able to share it is a nice thing, or a good thing to be able to say. You know, there's still things I struggle with now. I still get angry at people for what, you know, I'm still a child in me. And as I'm starting to go through therapy and heal the old stuff that was even before mum and before dad, I'm having to relearn a lot of things. And so there's still a lot of, and I'm still struggling with stuff now. I still feel like I let mum down when she was dying, but I wish I'd spent more time with her, but I had to not be there. I think I've heard it said that men find it difficult to deal with long-term illness and death. And I think I avoided it, and I think I could have been stronger, and that's a really hurtful thing. And there's also, I listened to a really good football podcast with Aaron Lennon, who's a footballer who's been through mental health struggles, and he said on that one, he's glad he went through it, but he doesn't wish it on anyone. And that's certainly the way I feel about it. Like, I obviously wish Mum was here for Dad, but also I'm so grateful that I've been on this journey of learning. And the hard part of that, though, is that now I understand Mum always had depression. Her mum had depression, like, quite bad. And now I think I'm the person that Mum needed me to be, but she had to die for me to be that person. And that breaks my heart. But then what it's enabled me to go is, well, who does my wife need to be? And can I be that person without her dying for me to be that? You know, so it's an incredible... Mum's death would be bad if I didn't take learnings from it and didn't bring it. So I'm trying to make her proud by living a life that takes the opportunities and understands from it. Her death hasn't gone unnoticed in the strength that I'm able to give to other people and by learning about myself. So I'm trying to honour her more through that, but it raises a lot of challenges.
I appreciate you so much sharing that. You know, we cover a lot of important topics, obviously, on this podcast, but I'm so glad that we have had the opportunity to talk about mental health at a critical point and in the detail we've gone into. It's such an important topic, so thank you so much for discussing it. It feels slightly strange to now switch gears to talk about you know, data and advertising and everything else.
Now let's go.
But we'll do our best. So we'll start with kind of its most basic level. Let's talk about data. What does data mean to you? How would you define it? And how does data impact organizations as it relates to strategy, creativity, and teams?
Oh, it's big questions, isn't it? And it's things that lots of people have got lots of opinions on. I think defining what does data mean to me, it's information. That's all it is. It's nothing new. People seem to have got bored of the idea of big data, right? Before it was all about big data. Everyone wants big data. And people who've had big data, they've realized it's really big and it's really difficult to work with. And it seems to be less sexy than it was. Now it's, oh my God, we need to get AI. AI will deal with the big data. So I think data is information, right? And I really, in this world, there's a lot of semantics and lots of what did you say versus what did you mean? I'm not saying you didn't say anything you mean. The way I've interpreted the question is we need to be really clear on what we mean between data, then translating that into information and then creating insight out the back of it, because we're trying to understand that journey, data, information, insight. Actually, it becomes very clear. When I first started in the industry in 2008, my role was more about the ability to understand the complexity and be able to explain that simply, whereas now there's less information dissymmetry between clients and part and planning people, and so now it's about what the best thing to do in that is, right? And so the point of that is that I think now there's a bit of information dissymmetry creeping in all of the data worlds, where we try and gatekeep our importance, we try and make ourselves important by gatekeeping the understanding of the complexity of data. Oh no, you don't understand data, you need analytics people, you need data scientist people. Actually, it's very, very simple in understanding it, because you go data. And if we talk about how your question about how it impacts organizations in strategy, creativity, and teams, well, if you think about the three elements, it's very clear, because you go data, then you go, well, how is it collected? Massive question, legal question, moral question. How is the data collected? Why on earth are you collecting data? And I really understand that I'm speaking, who I'm speaking to. And so, but I think actually a lot of the question I ask is why? Why are you collecting this data? What use is it? Because it's really expensive to collect. It's really expensive to store. It's really expensive to normalize. Why are you collecting this data? Do people know what they're consenting to? Technically, they have. Do they understand? If you ask the person on the street, if you had their data, do they know what you're doing with the data? I would argue 99% of the time is no. Where is the data going? So once you understand the data is information amount collection, hugely important. I've worked with clients where they had no data, FMCG brand. And they said, we're going to collect 150 million records so we can run analysis and use it for targeting. Cool. Hugely expensive. Hugely expensive, hugely time consuming, massive opportunity cost as well. If we weren't doing that, what could we have been doing? That's what we need to be thinking about. But that's not to say it's a no for most people. Most clients will benefit as long as they're sensible with it. So then we get into information. So how, and the biggest question that nobody talks about is how do we make that data clean and interoperable? So obviously InfoSum is a great way of doing that. You know, I know who I'm speaking to. Like it's a great clean room solution for matching first and second party data. But that's really difficult for a lot of people. You go and collect data in one market from three different sources. Matching that data is a nightmare. Whether you've got consent or not, forget that for a minute. Matching that data is a nightmare. Making data interoperable and recent is really, really difficult. So once you've managed to clean it up, make it useful together, how is it presented? Where is it presented? What can we do with that data? Obviously, it's great for some. And then the third part is insight. So what is interesting in that data and what's missing in the data? What's it showing that is missing or what is not in the data? So once you go those three spaces of data about collection and bringing it into one place, information about how it's storing and swearing, information about how you store it, how you make it interoperable, and then three, insight, where to do with it. It's really simple how you use data in strategy, in creativity, in teams. So, and it's not difficult to understand. It's really, really difficult to do, especially multi-market.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, and you touched on it a little bit there, you know, there's a great responsibility that comes from collecting data, right? If we look at it just from a privacy and security perspective, especially as we've seen kind of first-party data become such a critical component of most organizations' data strategies. So from your perspective and from your experience, how can companies responsibly make the most out of the data that's available to them?
I think you need to know what to do with it and know why it was collected in the first place. Because the question is worded, how can companies responsibly make the most of the data available to them? So if they've only got this data that's available, you have to understand why and where it was collected, right? So what was the purpose? What mode were people in when they collected it? Are they very willingly signing up for data? Is there a value exchange where people are just giving consent because they want something? The quality of the data is going to be different in those two scenarios. So understanding what you're able to get out of the data from that situation is really important. I'd much rather have a small amount of really useful and usable data than a bucket load of mildly useful, difficult to stitch together data. I do challenge the need for first party data most of the time, because you come back to the time and opportunity cost and what does it tell you that you can't get from elsewhere. First party data doesn't necessarily drive incrementality and growth in that respect. Obviously it can drive growth in terms of cross-selling and upselling, and it can help you with models for lookalikes, but can you get greater breadth incrementality from breadth anyway? Richard Charlton says that advertising growth is built in the wastage or something like that. And I think first post data is the opposite of that. Not a problem. Mm. Just don't try and do everything with it.
Yeah. Obviously, we touched on it right at the start and we haven't really come back to it. But when you talk about first party data, inevitably you talk about the cookieless future. We talk about the shifts in measurement and how we measure success and campaign success. And I think a common misconception that we have come up against at InfoSum is that you can't have both privacy and performance. And I think, you know, we're fortunate at InfoSum, we've been doing this a long time, so we've been able to kind of prove that to not be the case. But what are your thoughts on the kind of privacy and performance balancing act and any other common misconceptions and maybe even challenges regarding measurement specifically?
I love this question. I love the idea that you can't have people knowing what you're doing with the data and having a choice and then having performance as well. I love that idea that we have to invade people's privacy and have the surveillance economy in order to drive performance. That is insane to me. That, and morally, I believe in the industry if that was the case. I can't deal with that. I will cut my nose off to spite my face for the sake of having values, if that analogy works. But the question in terms of you can't have privacy and performance, if we ignore that side of it, it's built on a premise that actually I despise in digital, which is that because we can, we should. I think digital media's biggest failing is that because we can measure everything, we do. I think there's a law, isn't there? One of those laws which is when a measure becomes a target, it ceases to be a good measure. And I think you have a look at how many measures we've got in digital. We can measure away in any a campaign in a million different ways. Mm. And we say, oh, they're good. You know, it's very easy for me to go and marginally increase a metric and try and prove value in what I do. And actually, the first question I'd be asking to an organic social department, if everyone client side, would be, what incrementality does this drive? And how do you prove it? Because if you can't, what we're doing. And I know that sort of contradicts the point about measures becoming metrics and things, but what's the incrementality that click-through rate drives? Because I can tell you that it's zero. Click-through rate is my favorite metric because it's utterly meaningless. 80% of clicks are done by 8% of people. Comscore told us this in 2009. It's not different now. And you can go through all the measures that we use. The other one that drives me insane, and this doesn't rely on privacy, but is it speaks to the same belief of because we measure we can, is completed views on video. I don't understand why we optimize towards completed views on video. There's a great study I found by, I've had to write this down, Peter Dunner and Tracy Dagger, which is it's called Comparing the Relative Effectiveness of Advertising Channels. And there was a great graph in there which showed the effectiveness of an ad by amounts of second watch. You can get 80% of the effectiveness of a 30-second ad. So you can get 80% of the effectiveness of a 30-second ad after half the ad. So 15 seconds into a 30-second ad, you've got 80% of the effectiveness, which means you're 80-20 in it. The last 20%, the last 15 seconds you've got to optimize towards are only giving you marginal increases in effectiveness. And actually, it's better to go out and deliver two lots of 15-second ads rather than trying to push for one. And if you're optimizing towards the one with the completed view, you're going to cut out everything with a low chance of being viewed to at least half. And that speaks to the point we don't need privacy in order to understand what effectiveness. How many attribution systems rely on privacy invading methods? None. You don't need them. And I think it's very easy to game these metrics. I think about we had a consultancy, I love consultancies, obviously, come in and they said, we're going to redo your KPIs. And they said, so what I want you to do, we're going to do a quality KPI. What we're going to do is we're going to take the average CPM for every activity in a local market. And we're going to take your average viewability, divide one by the other, and get a viewable CPM. That is your target to beat this year. So my Italian team went, cool. I mean, that idea is insane anyway. You take all your branding, all your performance, have one CPM, video, display, whatever. Insane. And they said, cool, we've got a target. So what they did was they bought a bucket load of sticky banners on mobile, which have got a guaranteed viewability of 100% because they are on the screen. CPM was higher than average, so they got fewer impressions, but the viewable CPM was lower than target. So they nailed it. Did they drive incrementality? Probably not. And so we've needed to rethink what performance means anyway. What do we mean by performance? Doesn't mean we can't have privacy and the ability to target slash spam people we know are incredibly likely to buy with the bottom of the funnel ad to measure effectiveness using digital only measurements. Well, no, we can't do that anymore. But that isn't performance anyway. That's just a self-fulfilling circle where you mark your own homework with measures that aren't that useful. I think what the cookieless future is less about targeting, which everyone seems to be focused on. It's more about measurement and people in the digital world having to examine their value systems and try and understand how they are driving value for their businesses. Obviously, there's a need to monitor some metrics like click-through rate just to see if anything's going horrendously bad. But I think you can have privacy and can drive effectiveness because we did it before. We could track people. We will do it afterwards. I think what we're actually worried about is, can we measure badly and not have privacy? And that's the worry people have. But I would argue that they're not doing a great job anyway.
Yeah, it's super fascinating. I find the measurement world incredibly interesting. Obviously, it's incredibly complex. I often consider the fact that, you know, yes, you can measure everything, but, you know, we go back to, I think you said it was 1996 and the commercial you saw featuring Eric Cantona that was for Nike. And, you know, there's a good chance you still have very positive feelings about Nike and you're highly likely to buy their products because of an advert you saw X number of years ago. Obviously, you can't measure that, but, you know, clearly it's had an impact. So, you know, there's the art and the science of advertising, and clearly the art is always going to resonate incredibly well if done well.
There's a great study by Thinkbox and Mediacom. And if it was a publicist agency, obviously I'd give a shout out to them, but it was done by one of ours. I'm not I'm neutral in my praise, where it showed the influence of channels on other channels. And that's the thing that a lot of people in the digital world don't think about is, and we saw what it shows in there is TV drives 20% of the performance of display anyway. You know, so if you've got TV and display performance, display is boosted, but display search, there's nothing for other channels. I think it's great for selling products. You know, if you want someone just to get in there and buy a product, that's great. But we saw from ASOS, we saw from Airbnb, who put all their money into performance-based metrics to sell products, is that it will do a very, very short-term job. But for long-term branding and building why people come back to you rather than looking for a specific product, you need to have longer-term metrics, which you don't measure with click-through rate. And I think that's really important to measure. ASOS actually came out and said that they found people were using them and they only saw products. They didn't see the ASOS brand anymore. So they only came to them when they needed a specific thing rather than for browsing or because they trusted what the brand was giving them was quality. I believe I'd have to dig through reports that I read. And if I'm wrong, I'm sorry. But the idea that performance is purely selling products will eventually hit a plateau, and they'll need a bit like all those online only brands. You know, we saw Harry's Razors, which is great. Online only, we'll sell it on search and stuff. And suddenly they need to be in supermarkets and they need to have a physical footprint because that's where growth comes from. So I'm blathering a bit, but I performance really frustrates me because it's a very short-sighted way of looking at the success of advertising.
Yeah, I think that makes a ton of sense. Look, we've covered a lot since we've started recording, and this has been a super interesting conversation. Is there anything that we haven't mentioned or anything we haven't touched on that you feel you would like to kind of pick up before we close things off?
Yeah. Well, firstly, thank you. One of the questions I didn't able to get to was about fatherhood and parenthood. It's really important to me, particularly fatherhood, not in a, you know, male lives matter too moment, but also because it's important to talk about fatherhood because it's the only time in my life I've experienced sexism. You know, I went into John Lewis to do the baby tour just out of interest because it was free, and they didn't look at me, they only looked at Emma. The only thing they asked me the entire time, they were asking Emma about what baby were we having, where were we living, what sort of things do we want to do, do we want to be natural, that sort of stuff. The only thing they asked me was what the chassis number of our bugaboo was, and that's cool, but it shows that there's a lack of support for fathers specifically. And I think for our generation, speaking me and you, yeah, specifically Ben, is yeah. when you choose to have a kid, and for me having a kid, we are not set up to be parents now, and the difference between the generations, what it means to be a father in between the generations, is bigger than it's ever been before. What is meant to be, it is for me to be a father, is so different from my dad. And actually versus his dad, wasn't as different, and his dad going back wasn't that different. But for me, it's completely different. So my makeup of what it is, my socialization and what it is to be a father and the behaviors that are inside me are not right. And I think that's, we need to talk about that more. And I think it's not a problem. I'm not saying mothers don't go through horrendously difficult things. They absolutely do. But I'd like to see more space given for fathers. One thing I'm doing with dad, a small selfish plug, is I talked to dad about all the stuff I've talked to you about, so I'm able to be very open about it, because he had a tough life. He had the accident, he had a tough upbringing. His dad was obviously in the war, his dad was an alcoholic, made them homeless at times, so he's had a tough life. So he's got all these things, never been to therapy. I've been to therapy, not set up to be a dad because of his fathering, but did he try his best? Absolutely. I've got mental health things because of him, but also he's lost mum. It's a massive crazy web, so let's talk about it. And we've been talking. I see him every Friday for lunch, we talk about it, we go deep on this stuff. So I was like, let's talk about it. So we've talked about it. We're doing a 10-part podcast. It's called Talking About My Generation. I've recorded 7 episodes. It's an in-depth discussion, the same way we're talking about, but talking about what mum meant to him, what it meant to me, how I experienced his parenting, how that's translated into how I parent, and what gaps I've meant to talk about. We go through all these things. I think it's a really interesting exercise to talk about the generations. And I've mentioned it to a few people because it's not out yet, so I don't want to talk about it too much. But one person told me, like, it's a really powerful thing because he's got so many things he wanted to say to his dad, but he can't say. And so this at least gives him some peace in that he could say it, or that there are conversations that are able to be had. And that's what I'm talking about, is about just giving people options. So it'll be on my LinkedIn when it's out. It's not out yet. It's called Talking About My Generation. But I'm finding it strangely powerful.
That's definitely super important. You know, you'll have to let me know when that drops, and we'll be sure to to promote it. I think it's super important. I think, you know, the changing in the kind of the what has been traditional gender roles when it comes to having children has definitely been like, I've seen a massive shift in our generation, to your point. So I think the more that we can do to set up for the next generation, for your children when they're parents, to have a more positive experience, I guess, you know, talking to some of the experiences you had in the retailer around the kind of slightly more negative experience, how can we ensure there's a more positive experience for those mothers and fathers, and parents as a whole, as they kind of, as the next generation come along?
Yeah. I 100% agree. The actual thing I'd written down for this answer, because I've bounced back to the other one, was my secret weapon is just generosity. I think generosity always, always, always pays back massive dividends. It's never not helped. Even if, you know, if I'm generous with time and space and empathy, and just giving people the benefit of the doubt, that's a huge part of generosity. It always pays back, even if it's not from that person, but it's from the culture that you're building. And that would be the thing that I think is paid back the most in my career, more than any MBA or any, I haven't got an MBA, but any learning, any courses, anything I've ever done, is just being generous has always paid back. I don't know if you could say it's purely altruistic, because maybe I know I'm getting something out of it, but I just always recommend generosity, always.
I love that. I think that's a fantastic way to end things. Before we close off completely, you know, obviously this podcast is about people like yourself who are I would normally say who are pioneering in new ways to use data, but obviously just pioneering in new ways to lead data, to use data, to lead, to be open, empathetic leaders. I think it's super important. So when you look at people you admire in the industry, who would you nominate for us to interview on an upcoming episode?
I've been really lucky to meet an amazing group of people, you know, and a bunch of other great people. The person I'm nominating is a person called Mabo Besabetnia, or I know her as M. I met her when she was client role. She's up for doing the pod. She's held exec roles at Amazon, McDonald's, HSBC, Mars, GSK. Like, she is a heavyweight, but also she's kind. She's my mentor. Like, we're genuinely very close friends. And I think we just get on, and she has done amazing things, and she comes from an amazing, she's had to fight. I don't want to ruin any of the stories, but she's had to fight to be where she is and to be who she is. And she's just amazing. So M is my answer.
That's awesome. We will definitely reach out and try and get on the podcast as soon as possible. Andrew, thank you so much for being on the podcast. You know, I mentioned it earlier, mental health still doesn't get the airtime I feel it deserves and that is critical that it gets. So I'm so glad that we had such an opportunity to talk about such an important topic. So I just appreciate you being on the podcast so much.
Thank you for giving me a platform to be able to talk and to be able to talk to you as well. So thank you very much.
Thanks again to Andrew for joining me on the podcast. Only through consistent and open conversation about our mental health and mental well-being can we continue to remove much of the stigma that still exists around it. So I am thankful to Andrew for being so open and generous with his experiences on the podcast. All that leaves for me to do is to remind you to hit that subscribe button so you'll know when the next episode of Identity Architects lands. But until then, thanks for listening.